Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. That's the one and only super producer, Mr. Max Williams. Give him some hands. They don't have to be your own.
But don't throw hands.
Don't
like,
throw
give
hands.
Him. Put them together for him.
Or put your hands up if you're not driving.
Deserve your fisticuffs, you know?
Right?
Keep your hands in your pockets if you're going to be throwing those things around.
Yes, that is hand advice from your fellow Ridiculous Historians. Ben, Noel, you and I were both very taken by the whimsy of a quote that our old pal Gabe dug up for today's episode. I say we split it just because it's so much fun to read. Is that cool with you?
Totally.
Okay. All right. Here we go.
Call us not weeds. We are flowers of the sea, for lovely and bright and gay-tinted are we.
And quite independent of sunshine and showers. Oh, call us not weeds. We are ocean's gay flowers.
Now, based
I knew you were going to do the weedy old man voice on that one, Ben. I knew you were going to do that.
It demands it. It demands it, Noel.
It really does.
and I love how we were leaning into the invisible H's after those W's.
Call us not weeds.
So based on that description, it may be a little bit tough to guess what the subject of that rhyme is. However, if you play it back and if you listen to it and treat it like, you know, unpacking a riddle, a lot of us have probably guessed correctly. That is a little poem about seaweed. Noel, Max, you guys have eaten Japanese cuisine, right? You've had like seaweed salad and so on.
Yeah, I like seaweed salad. It's one of those things that I, you know, discovered when I worked at this restaurant back in Augusta. It's also the place where I learned to cook and really enjoy cooking. But it was the kind of thing I probably never would have thought out on my own, but it was on the menu and I tried it and I love it. I mean, it's obviously a lot of it has to do with the sesame flavoring and the seasoning and all that. It is a little on the slimy side, but once you get past the texture or maybe even lean into the texture, it is delicious. But then there's crispy versions of it.
Oh,
you can get little seaweed snacks or the kind of wraps that you use for hand rolls, for example, or even like, you know, the kind of, what do you call the sushi that's with the rice and the seaweed wrap? What is that called? That's sashimi?
I think the wrap is nori.
That's well, nori, but there's a name for the kind that's wrapped. Like, there's sashimi is just the fish. And then there's nigiri. That's just on rice. And then there's another name for the one with the seaweed around it.
That's like
people
a hand
are yelling
roll.
At their phones. You know, the hand roll. But I'm talking about the little sliced ones. You know, the little pieces. Rice on the inside. It's like a layer of seaweed, layer of rice, and then the good stuff on the inside. There's another name for that. But we'll just leave that to people to yell at their podcast apps.
I know what that one is. Yeah, I don't want to get too caught in the weeds, but I...
And the weeds, you say?
Oh, and the seaweeds. There we are. Yeah, but we're
I want to jump in. Is it nori maki?
Oh, it's maki. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Maki rolls. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Boom. Yes. Back to the facts. Good too. Really makes me miss just being able to stroll into a convenience store in Japan and eat like a king so inexpensively. But
well, there's always grocery store sushi, Ben. There's always grocery store sushi.
There is. And we are lucky enough to have some really good sushi spots here in Atlanta. But being so far inland and not being in Japan, we do pay a premium for that. So really good sushi is kind of a special occasion thing for us here. But seaweed goes so far beyond sushi. We're just talking about sushi because we like food, and that's going to be the main touch point for us in the world of seaweed. But seaweed's been around forever. Everybody knows what it is. You don't have to live by the ocean to know about seaweed. And today's episode, which was arguably cursed for a while, is about a very weird Victorian hobby. People started getting into seaweed, like treating it as though it were almost like Pokemon today.
As though it were? As if it were so?
Just so.
I love it. We teased it a little bit in the episode that we did with the Ridiculous Romance crew, that we had an episode coming up that involves scrapbooking to some degree, because we were talking about Valentine's and, like, you know, making lace kind of, you know, little ephemera. And today really does kind of discuss the art of scrapbooking, specifically seaweed scrapbooking, as kind of a weird form of women's empowerment in the Victorian age, because as many folks know, the 19th century was not the most liberating of times for women, especially in Victorian England, where they were, you know, kept in many respects, in most respects, in fact, outside of the ones that we're going to talk about today. They were required chaperones in order to venture outside of the home. They were, you know, largely, almost exclusively treated as kind of domestic servants, essentially, in service to their male counterparts. But it wasn't really counterpart because there was no equality there whatsoever. More like their male masters, honestly. That's kind of how it was treated, though, sort of the attitude of the time. But there was a new thing happening. A very widespread interest in the natural sciences. And that was because of discoveries from people like Darwin. Who else, Ben, was contributing to this interest in nature?
Oh, so much. There's so much stuff here. We're talking about a time of great scientific discovery and breakthroughs. And we're talking about some deep and profound paradigm shifts in society at this time. Because you pointed out the dichotomy in which this story takes place. Everybody is fascinated by scientific investigation, right? People want to, as hobbies, learn more about the natural world, but at the same time, society only wants certain members of the population to learn. Like if you're a little dude, then go get your chemistry set. But if you're a woman, whether child or adult, then civilization is telling you, whoa, that's men's stuff. Stay home. Mm-hmm. And yeah. You can like music and you can like to decorate things. But that's where we draw the line. And don't talk to me about voting. That's what society would say.
100%. If you're a dude, go watch that bird. Hell, kill that bird. Stuff that bird. Mount that bird. You know, like mounted, like taxidermy, you know, because at the again, another big figure at this time was John James Audubon, you know, who established the Audubon Society. You mentioned the idea of membership. The things like the Audubon Society inspired countless smaller kind of offshoots and clubs, organizations where members would participate in different outdoorsy type activities, whether it be bird watching or rock collecting or, you know, mineral hunting or whatever. But women were almost exclusively not permitted to join these clubs, except when it came to the idea of taking in the country air, yes. You know, going for a dip in the ocean, you know, but not too far, just a dip of the toe, and make sure to keep on those petticoats, ladies, because otherwise it would be untoward. But it's true. There became this sort of offshoot of all this naturalism that was considered like for the girls. And it was the collecting of seaweed, the collecting, drying, and preserving in albums or scrapbooks of seaweed was huge, particularly in the middle class, not only in England, but also in New England, in America.
Yeah, this was a transatlantic phenomenon. And I love the idea of people taking a constitutional. I just enjoy Victorian phrases so very much. People are into fur and feathers. They're into taxidermy. We're seeing the age of the self-described gentleman scientist, which I love. I love the idea of a gentleman scientist. They travel across the planet, just collecting plants and animals, describing them, classifying them. It's cool to be a nerd at this time. A lot of people want to be nerds, but there's still a lot of misogyny. This misogyny is not going to hold. It's not a sustainable type of discrimination in this part of history because we're seeing the democratization of technology and of learning. There are more rail networks expanding, you know, definitely in the UK, and more people are having more free time. So you don't necessarily have to be a viscount or an archduke to care about studying, you know, birds or bats or what have you. You now just are a person who has a hobby. Microscopes are no longer insanely expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Bird collecting clubs, well, collecting clubs of any kind start spring up like wildfire across Britain. And this is where I think we should introduce a guy named Dr. Stephen Hunt, a researcher in environmental humanities working at the University of the West of England. And he notes all these factors and says that because of this, in the 19th century, Britain became a hotbed of biological enthusiasm and natural history encountered this sort of, you could call it a renaissance, but not the Renaissance time period, a renaissance in interest. It's an amazing time for scientists.
It really is. And Cara Giaimo over at Atlas Obscura wrote a really fantastic article called The Forgotten Victorian Craze for Collecting Seaweed that we refer to for this episode quite a few times. And these quotes from Dr. Stephen Hunt were originally seen in that article. And Hunt really describes it beautifully when he describes this as a democratization of natural history, you know, in the same way that I like to refer to, I mean, not just me, but like the democratization of technology is what is allowed in the era that we currently live in, a lot of art to flourish, a lot of music to flourish. People now have GarageBand on their computers that comes like pre-installed. It's a lot more affordable to get a decent DSLR camera. Hell, they're on your phone, you know? So that is a similar situation where because of the things you were saying, Ben, like the prices of microscopes becoming much more affordable to, you know, maybe not the average person, but at the very least middle class. I guess that is kind of average, isn't it? So let's just, yeah, go back. The average person. It was a big deal. People were able to kind of become these fair weather kind of natural history enthusiasts. But again, not women. And a lot of this, too, had to do with the shift to wage earning, wage labor, creating this very novel concept of free time. You know, people weren't just like spinning yarn in the factory anymore, or like, you know, shoveling coal. There was a lot more time to do things for leisure. By the way, I learned in this other article that we looked at, collectorsweekly.com, who published an article called When Housewives Were Seduced by Seaweed, Scandalous, that refers to the idea of a withdrawing room. I didn't know that drawing room was short for withdrawing room. And I want to say, isn't it a really kind of superfluous shortening? Like, is withdrawing that much longer than just drawing? I don't know that that was necessary, but it's funny. The withdrawing room was, of course, like, you know, the parlor, right? Where people would hang out and maybe do their little crafts.
Yeah, exactly. This is also the age where the well-to-do people have very specific rooms or areas of their estates. The orangery, right? Where you just grow oranges to flex on people. So it's not too unusual, but it stinks to be a woman or someone identifying as female and have this same interest in the natural world and continually get stonewalled by people. It may strike many of us as odd or paradoxical or hypocritical today to realize that the folks who were really into learning and thought of themselves as very intelligent were also very into gatekeeping. The Royal Society, the Linnaean Society, all of those groups refused female members, and some wouldn't even let them show up to the public speeches where we're like, mm-hmm. Hey, let's explain what a badger is. And women weren't allowed to hunt animals. It was seen as too dangerous. And digging up plants was, get this, seen as like too erotically charged.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
That's because, well, why? Because plants like reproduce, you know, like, isn't it asexually though? I don't fully understand. Well, I mean, maybe some plants are vaguely vaginal, but honestly, what's more vaginal and kind of erotic than seaweed?
Just wait when these guys hear about Georgia O'Keeffe. Anyhow, like the Linnaean botany, like this thought was based on the sexual parts of the plant, according to Dr. Hunt. So it was seen as controversial and, as we said earlier, untoward to be digging plants out of the ground because it was too sexually charged. And that's where seaweed comes in.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This story is strange, but seaweed is seen as very wholesome. It's very like innocuous. It doesn't have a bunch of sex organs that worry the more prudish people in society. And it's kind of close to home because a lot of people live on the coastline. So it's considered healthy and wholesome or allowable for women to go take in the shore and stroll along the beach. They might just go on a family vacation. They might be trying to get to a place with better weather because of a medical condition. And a lot of them are already really into scrapbooking. So they notice that seaweed has such a vast variety of sizes and shapes. And they started saying, hey, this is decoration. Society will allow us to do decoration. They'll allow us to do scrapbooking. But at the same time, we are going to be able to satisfy some part of our scientific curiosity without the boys' clubs of the world shutting us down yet again.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, things like pressing flowers or drying and pressing flowers was already pretty popular, despite the hilarious idea of plants being controversial because of their sexuality. That just really cracks me up. But this is just kind of an extension of that. Seaweed and is perfectly fit for this because it can flatten out beautifully. And you can, you know, kind of paste it to a page. You can even use photographic technology or photographic techniques to create what are called cyanotype prints. There was a very well-known book at the time by Anna Atkins called Photographs of British Algae. This is in the 1840s, by the way. And she used essentially just photographic, light-sensitive, you know, photographic paper to create these cyanotype prints to document these various types of seaweed. And when you look at some of these books, I would really recommend checking out that Atlas Obscura article. Ben, I know you're a big fan of the Voynich manuscript. Mm-hmm. I think you own a copy of it. We've talked about it many times on our other podcast, Stuff That I Don't Want You to Know. For anyone that's not familiar, it is a mysterious book that kind of chronicles a lot of, like, alien flora and fauna, but more flora really, right, than fauna. I guess it has some kind of like creatures depicted in it, but a lot of it very seaweed like, wouldn't you say? And also very similar layout to what you see in some of these British, you know, seaweed scrapbooks.
Yeah, yeah, and I love whenever somebody mentions that manuscript. I'd also like to shout out a thematic successor to that, the Codex Serafinaeus. So shout out to Luigi Serafini for making a on purpose incomprehensible book. It's such a great read. Maybe we should start a book club. But how do you start a book club with books that are designed not to be legible? Anyway, story for another day, but you are right. People are all of a sudden in the world of publishing discovering that books on identifying and preserving seaweed are a surefire bet. People are going to buy them. So now there's a market motivation to popularize this idea. More and more people get involved. We mentioned New England, we mentioned the UK, also Canada. A lot of Canadian people start going into tide pools to collect and press seaweed of their own. Now, it didn't get as popular as some other hobbies at the time, because you needed a little more technical aptitude to press seaweed, and seaweed doesn't grow everywhere. It's in the name. You know what I mean? So if you are inland, you're going to have to take a trip. You're going to have to physically go somewhere to engage in this hobby. And there were, to be clear, there were some male seaweed collectors, but they lived a very different life. They were starting on third base in this endeavor. They were able to be scientists.
They did it by choice. They could have done whatever else they wanted, but they chose the seaweed life. The seaweed life didn't choose them.
Yeah, yeah, well put. So women were, you know, again, not seen as scientists by the powers that be at this point. So if a guy is collecting seaweed, like if Max is out collecting seaweed and makes a book about it, then Max is going to be treated like the preeminent scientist of seaweed. And then if we had, you know, like Eves Jeffcoat doing the same work at the same time, society would have instead treated her as like a person with a quirky, cute hobby, even though they were both like conducting real science.
Absolutely. And let's not forget, this is something that really takes some talent, at the very least stick-to-itiveness and the ability to really like learn how to do this correctly. Because like you said, Ben, it wasn't nearly as easy as maybe dried flowers. Not anyone could do this. The article that I mentioned earlier in Collectors Weekly, When Housewives Are Seduced by Seaweed, by Hunter Oatman Stanford, has a really great quote that I think sums this up nicely. He says, part of the appeal was what a seaweed collection said about the collector. Anyone could appreciate and collect flowers, but painstakingly obtaining, preserving, and mounting seaweed specimens demonstrated patience, artistic talent, and the refined sensibilities necessary to appreciate the more subtle beauties of nature. And in fact, Queen Victoria was known, of the Victorian age, Queen Victoria was known to have made a seaweed album when she was a young lady.
See, even the queen approves. Off mic, Max, you had some?
I was just going to say at the moment that I resent you for putting me in that comparison, making me the bad guy.
Oh, we'll keep it.
No.
Sorry, Max. I have a little list to the right of my monitor of who has to be the bad cop. So I rotated out, but prioritize the three of us over guests just because we could take it, you know, usually. Mm-hmm. You'll be the good guy in a later example.
Sure.
Okay. All right. And hold me to that. So you make a great point, Noel, too, that the idea that the most powerful political figure and social figure in the country also approves. People are going to be incredibly hesitant to criticize seaweed collecting when the monarchy itself is engaged in it. And there's a religious aspect here that we also have to acknowledge. It's discussed by Peter Harrington over at peterharrington.co.uk, where he explores this idea of the interrelationship of seaweed collecting in society. And he said, if you go to his website, actually, you'll see a real live seaweed scrapbook. And it looks really cool. It looks professional. There's a great artistry to it. But for the Victorians, the natural world was still very much tied to religious and moral ideas. So if you were going to defend yourself, if you're identifying as female at this time and somebody's giving you a hard time about seaweed collecting, what you could do is say, well, this, I'm, you know, very pious, and this gives me a new appreciation of the world God created. And then people would say, all right, as long as you're not doing science, right? Okay. Then we'll back to whatever game we're playing in the withdrawing room. Whist? Is Whist a card game? What is Whist?
Whist. One can be whistful. So it should, logic follows that Whist is a thing that one can be full of. But I don't know what it is.
It is a game. And it's a game they would have played. Right? You know, Max. What is Whist?
Whist is a classic English trick-taking card game. I am totally not reading this off Wikipedia, which was played widely in the 18th and 19th centuries. Although the rules are simple, there is a scope for a strategic play. So yeah, there's no answer in what I just said right there.
Interesting. And also not reading off of Wikipedia, I'm reading off of Etymology Online. Etym Online, that's a portmanteau. Ooh, it's hard to say. Wistful is actually described as being closely attentive. I always thought wistful meant you were kind of like melancholy or morose. Nostalgic. I've been misusing that, I guess. It says here, wistful. Well, never mind. The etymology is a little different than maybe the way it's used in, you know, the parlance of our times. But it does refer to an early 17th century kind of, I guess, obsolete kind of translation of the word whistly, which could have been influenced by the word wishful. So unrelated to the game whist, I was hoping there was a connection. But as is the case with etymology, sometimes the obvious seeming thing has nothing to do with anything.
Yeah, like the word lepidopterist. They study butterflies and moths.
Well, but Lepidoptera is the genus, I believe, of butterflies, right?
Yes. Yeah. And we know this because I introduced this. I was waiting for a chance to use that word for years and years, and it came up in Strange News, which is a weekly segment we do on stuff they don't want you to know. We're always learning weird and strange things. So shout out to any lepidopterist in the crowd, amateur or professional. And good luck with QAnon. That's part of the story. You'll have to tune in to see what we're talking about. But that's
please
a real
do. It's a fun episode. Yeah. Fun. Yeah. Results, mileage may vary on the fun, but we always inject some fun into the proceedings, even if it's a heavy topic.
We sure try, Noel. We sure try. So let's say you go to see a seaweed display and someone's like, look at the seaweeds I have collected. What would this look like? There's a cool website from Harvard University's library that talks about the process. Basically, first you clean it in salt water, then you place it on this special mounting paper, and then the collector kind of cleans it up. They might trim stuff they don't want on there. They'll spend some time carefully arranging it just so in a way they find aesthetically pleasing. Then it's layered between another kind of paper, blotting paper, and you just put a lot of weight on it until it dries and all the moisture is gone. So like 50 pounds of something, you know, and in that way, it's similar to pressing flowers. Here's what happens when you're doing this. Seaweed starts exuding a gunk, like a gelatinous material that sticks, that replaces adhesive. It's almost like okra, which is a mucilaginous vegetable. That's why okra has snot. And that's another word I never get to say. I am knocking them off the list here, man. But yeah, seaweed snot.
Yeah, but and I just have to say, okra for me is pretty useless unless fried and dipped in some sort of sauce, because I don't really particularly need snot inside my vegetables. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you know, teach their own. Teach their own. Some people look at okra and say, I've got enough snot already. But there, you just have, it's tricky to cook it, you know, well. Anyway, before I accidentally turn this into a segment on weird okra facts, it's pretty neat that the seaweed itself can produce its own glue. So you don't see actual glue holding the specimens down. And as far as the Harvard Library is concerned, this was a pretty great process, because it also removed any uncouth smells. They say that the album they have doesn't have an odor, but they're still on the fence about whether it doesn't smell because of the process of pressing it, or just because this book is also more old. And then going back to that collectorsweekly.com article that you mentioned earlier, Noel, there's a great moment in there where the author says, the Victorian era was also a more pungent time. So I suspect they either wouldn't have been bothered by the smell, or they would have used a creative method to minimize it. I love just thinking of an era of time as generally more pungent.
I mean, sure, we talked about in a past episode, the great stink of London. I mean, sewage for a time just ran rampant through the streets. It was a smelly, smelly time to be alive. Bathing was a real luxury for many folks, mm-hmm. even the upper class, you know. And what didn't they like wash their whites in urine sometimes, too?
Well, yeah, you know, sometimes you get in situations.
You sure do, Ben. You sure do.
That's one of those responses we just won't follow up on.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly.
So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's give some shout-outs to notable seaweed hunters. Right now, we don't know, in terms of solid numbers, we don't know how many people were out hunting and displaying seaweed. We mentioned Queen Victoria. She's one of the most famous seaweed collectors. Author George Eliot has talked about an interest in seaweeds, and some people did make some coin off of it. People like Margaret Gatti, who was an author of children's books and then started collecting seaweed while she was convalescing, recovering from illness in 1848 in the southeast of Britain. She was what people started to call a seaweeder. Her book, British Seaweeds, describes a ton of local seaweeds, and it's a really nice book. It's got colored plates. It's prestigious. It's what you would have like put on a coffee table to impress your guest.
Absolutely. And think about it, back in those days, I mean, there wouldn't be mass production of these types of, you know, very bespoke books. They would have been much rarer and like cooler, you know, with like engraved printing and, you know, gold foiling and things like that. I mean, that would have been a really cool book. It makes me like start wanting to get into like vintage book collecting. But that is a slippery slope, my friend.
A very deep
and expensive rabbit hole.
It really is. And I've got some nice books. I've got some.
I have a few from my dad, like old Dickens books that are very, very, very beautiful.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I've got some friends who collect books as well, but it can be a very expensive hobby. So you might, if you are a bibliophile, you might have a seaweed book of this sort somewhere in your collection. It's possible, because we know, just based on the number of these books that are around from that era, that it was a pretty popular pursuit. Now, even if you're at the level of Margaret Gatti, you're still not calling yourself a scientist. You're saying, I appreciate God's grace and nature's beauty. And if you read some of the statements that people make about this in this field, like Dr. Hunt points out, a lot of the writers were kind of self-deprecating. They really took pains not to anger those boys' clubs that wouldn't let them into the meetings, which stinks because they're doing valuable work. And in some cases, people came to rely on it just to spice up their day, to spice up the weeks. They called it a necessary repast. That's at least what Gatti said when she wrote a letter about seaweed collecting to her sister-in-law. And because they like the language they use is so evocative, it doesn't have the same kind of dry classification, technical writing aspects of what of like male seaweed hunters in British seaweeds. There's this one description. It's cool, and this was in this is in Atlas Obscura too. One specimen of seaweed is described as, get this, I thought you would like this word, delicately membranaceous.
Oh yeah,
membranaceous,
mucilaginous, and membranaceous. Yeah. Is this the same person that kind of gave some tips on how to go about it, the process, like for a novice?
Yes. Yeah. She's popularizing this. Gaddy is popularizing this and also is kind of an evangelist for Seaweed Collective.
Yeah, evangelist, as you mentioned earlier. I mean, there was a kind of religious reverie attached to this, process of somehow getting closer to what God hath made, you know, and all of that stuff. But Gaddy gives some tips, you know, to kind of further democratize this process and let, you know, maybe women that are wanting to kind of dip their toe in the in seaweed collecting, some tips on how to go about it. I mentioned earlier about the idea of wearing your petticoats, you know, while on the seaweed hunt. That came directly from her. She encouraged would-be seaweed hunters to continue to wear their petticoats on top, she said. But she refers to them as necessary draperies, right? But then suggests that they should wear men's boots and own it. She has this quote, feel all the luxury of not having to be afraid of your boots. Feel all the comfort of walking steadily forward, the very strength of the soles making you tread firm.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say, I remember I had this boss, this really cool older dude named Alan Cook, who he's a great guitar player. I worked for him at a radio station and he like did this classical music show. But he gave me this really good piece of advice one time. He said, if you're doing yard work, wear those really thick leather gardening gloves. He said, because they make you stronger. And he's right. If you're not afraid of, you know, dinging up your delicate, you know, fingies, you're going to grip things harder and you're going to be more confident. And I love this idea of like feeling the soles making you tread firm. You know, it reminds me of that piece of advice I got.
Yeah, yeah. That's great advice, honestly. There's another piece of advice that Gaddy gives where she says, she basically tells people to use the buddy system. She's, because, you know, they're still getting a little further away from urban areas. Shores can be dangerous. There's slippery rocks. Tides can be tricky if you get too far out. So that leads Gaddy to write, a low watermark expedition is more comfortably undertaken under the protection of a gentleman. So she also talks about how to convince a guy to go with you on this thing. And she says, you know, try to sweeten the pot with enticements. And she notes, he may fossilize or sketch, or even, if he will be savage and barbaric, shoot gulls. So it's like saying to, you know, a partner or someone you know who's a dude saying, I want to go seaweed hunting, but it'll be fun for you too. You can shoot some seagulls. I don't know, man, make the most of it. And that's how they would try to get a chaperone, because chaperoning was still very much a thing, right? And now that we've kind of laid out what this was, how popular it was, even though a lot of people today have never heard about it, we have to ask, why is it not around today? Why did it eventually, and we didn't make up
dry
this
up?
Pun. Yeah, yeah, why did it dry out? We've seen this pun referenced in multiple sources, or this wordplay. And this was a fad. It was a very popular fad, but it was a fad. And no, what do fads do? They just kind of go away after a time.
Sometimes, I don't know. Sometimes it's unfair to label something as a fad. It could just be cyclical, right? Sometimes things are really hot and then they kind of go away and they come back into fashion. So just because something is labeled as a fad doesn't mean it's like forever irrelevant. Who knows? There could be a new seaweed craze come back. People love all this kind of vintage stuff. And everyone that I've told about this, A, had no idea this was ever a thing, and B, is instantly like, oh, that kind of makes sense. That sounds kind of cool. Mm-hmm. But also, it does require sort of a position of privilege, doesn't it? Because you have to be near the seaside. You have to be geographically adjacent to a place where seaweed naturally occurs, or I don't know, maybe you can get it by mail, but that doesn't seem right. That doesn't seem like that would do the trick. I mean, I'm sure there's fancy ways of preserving the stuff in the mail, but that sort of like takes half the fun out of it, doesn't it?
Right. So this is weird because it became a little less popular as Victorian society began to be less uptight. It began to be okay to just say, I'm going to go have fun. You know what I mean? And so even if you look at a lot of the experts, they're not 100% sure exactly when seaweed collecting became less cool, but they're guessing it happened in the late 19th century as Victorian thoughts give way to what we would call modernism. And it's kind of hard to find scrapbooks or guidebooks past that area of time. But we can safely say it was probably still practiced by a few people. There may be people with this hobby today, because for some folks, there's a lot of nostalgia in it. You know, like I went and collected seaweed as a young child with my mother, and now I meet my sister every summer and we collect seaweed for our family seaweed book. That's cool. That's wholesome.
It is. All of this stuff's pretty wholesome. You know, this is one of the most wholesome episodes I think we've done in a while, aside from the whole rampant misogyny that sort of forced women to traipse around in ponds in men's boots, secretly, you know, obscured beneath their petticoats. But at the end of the day, this does kind of mark one of those crossover moments, Ben, you know what I mean? Between like a generation almost, where it's like the softening of the attitude, like, well, women can maybe collect seaweed and make scrapbooks. And then before you know it, enough time goes by, women can look through microscopes, and then women can, you know, work outside the home. Crazy to think, but it is little steps like this that lead to those larger overarching changes in the way, you know, society treated women.
Yeah, exactly. And there's another change that may be on the way. Scrapbooking is still very popular. I think our pal Diana Brown over at Ridiculous Romance told us she actually went to a scrapbooking convention one time.
That's right.
That's right. Yeah. And do check out Ridiculous Romance. We are huge fans of the shows. It's weird that we think like we see another sea change because scrapbooking is still around. But what happens when the idea of preserving ephemera like this? Shout out to you, Max. What happens when it moves into the digital realm? Like, yes, everybody has a camera on their phone, or a lot of people have cameras on their phones and they take excellent photos. But what are your odds of printing that and making a little book with it? You probably just forward it and say like, haha, last night was epic.
Oh, it's a really good point, Ben. And it's something that we haven't discussed at all, but I think we talked about a little bit off podcast. Yeah. The idea of, you know, my mom is very still fixated on having printed things because she's really comfortable with the digital realm. It's a really good Christmas present for her if I like take some cell phone photos and like get them printed, because there are, you know, websites that'll make a pretty nice high quality print out of these high resolution phone photos. But most people, you're right, don't go to those steps. And that's what puts things in the realm of ephemera. Shout out to Ephemeral, the show that our buddy Alex Williams and super producer Max Williams make together, in addition to a few other amazing folks. But it's a show about things that kind of disappear over time, whether because they're lost or they just deteriorate. There is something finite about these things, but in a way, something more lasting. Like, I don't know, like for some reason, like a digital file to me, while sure, it's technically indestructible, you couldn't reproduce it given an apocalypse event anymore if you didn't have the technology to encode it or to decode it. Mm-hmm. Whereas a wax cylinder or like a vinyl record or a photograph or something like that, you could find ways to probably rig something up to enjoy that. You know, like you could probably make a turntable out of a coconut and some pine needles or something. I mean, I'm sort of half joking, but I'm also not. Analog technology and just objects are, in some ways, you know, more real inherently.
Yeah, that's why I like older cars. That's why I prefer physical books, because the it's just different. Reading a book that way, the tangible aspect of it makes, in my opinion, whatever you're digesting feel more real. And that's a great point. Now this is where we're drawing a bit to a close. Margaret Gatti had a long life and she loved seaweed collecting up until she passed away in 1873. Her collections have survived. You can see them today at the St. Andrews University in Scotland, and curators have been working to restore these, to organize them. And she even has a species of Australian algae named after her, the Gattia pinella. So congratulations to you, Margaret Gatti. Although it took way too long, in my opinion, you did finally get your due. As a scientist, getting something named after you is pretty great, right? Mm-hmm.
It is pretty great. And wasn't there a spider or something that was named after Dave Coulier recently? Or I don't know. I'm also a fan of like celebrity namings of creatures. I know there's a David Bowie spider, you know, because like the spiders from Mars and all that.
There are some incredibly funny ones, but I'm trying to remember. There were some examples I saw of names that were meant to be insulting. Like you'd name a humble dung related animal after some politician or celebrity you didn't like, but just for fun, let me read you guys some real names for things from our friends at Mental Floss. Cause we always love to shout out Mental Floss. These are real scientific names. Turdus maximus. That's a bird.
Is that like Turd Ferguson related? I love that. Oh, Ben, I've already shouted you out for this, I believe. Maybe not on this show, but Ben gave me the most wonderful, thoughtful gift.
Oh,
it is,
yeah,
a book called Dumb Birds of North America. Mm-hmm. And the cover of it has a bird on it called like the North Kentucky butt nugget or something like that. And I'm not sure if how much of it is real and how much of it is just total farce, but it's like the only bird book that I would ever want to own. And I thank you again.
I'm so glad
wholeheartedly
you
for that. I have it in my bathroom. It's like the bathroom reader for when guests are, you know, taking repose.
That is a place of prestige. And all the entries, just to shout that book out, The Field Guide to Dumb North American Birds or Dumb Birds in North America. All the entries are, Max bleep me on this, are stuff like, you know, the great American and the first paragraph, it says something like, this motherfucker is a real piece of crap. You know what I mean? Like, it's not for children. But if you have some, I don't know, I think teenagers would like that book too, right? Like, your daughter likes it, I bet.
Oh, absolutely. And my girlfriend, Day, loves it. I think she is absolutely in love with that book. So it's a lot of fun. Check it out. But man, who knew that we could talk about seaweed scrapbooking for 45 minutes on a Tuesday?
I had a suspicion. And off air, we had been talking and I had said, okay, we might need to lean into the banter on this one and see what, you know, if we have any tangents that'll take us someplace really crazy. Which is leading to, I think, our first ever tangent tease. It turns out that our good buddy, Mr. Max Williams, is an expert in the sport of curling. And I don't know about you, Noel, but I have at best a very vague understanding of what curling is. So one day in an upcoming episode, we're going to have Max introduce us to curling, if you would be so kind, Mr. Williams.
Seems like you'll need a lot of stuff. You know, first you need an ice rink, then you need those stones and the weird brooms, yep, and special shoes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's a lot less than you'd think. But Ben, I do have a good, you know, teaser story. I remember it was the year was 2018. It was in February. I was actually hanging out with the esteemed Noel Brown at a cabin.
In the hot tub.
Like, yeah, I'm about to, like, you know, watch the gold medal match United States versus Sweden.
Uh-huh.
Noel, I think, just like looked at me. He goes, okay. And then went to the hot tub.
Sorry, I didn't mean to be dismissive. I just never met a curling enthusiast before.
I remember you just being very confused the entire. You're like, so wait, you're gonna stay up? Because you know it was in Korea,
right? It's very late.
It's like you're gonna stay up really late and watch this. I'm like, yeah. He's like, Okay.
All right. You know, you do you, buddy. That's how'd it go? You remember who won?
Oh, yes. United States won the gold medal.
Oh, my God.
Nice.
Congratulations. A year later or 2 years later.
So it, 4 years
it
later.
It felt worth it. Wow. Right. So this is just one example of many, many niche hobbies that came about during this time. There are other examples. Diatom arranging in particular is really neat. They kind of look like kaleidoscopes, if you ever had a kaleidoscope as a kid. But maybe those are a story for another day. I had a blast doing this one. We beat the curse I referenced. I guess we should mention that we wanted to do this episode for a while, and we started wondering whether it was cursed.
Yeah, it was largely because of guest obligations, not obligations. We love all our guests, and we had some incredible ones recently for some shows in the Extended Ridiculous Universe, the ERU, right? Is that the one? And then we had some illness that caused some problems and some scheduling things. But you're right. It's definitely one that we've punted quite a few times. But the good news is that because of that, I think we both got to spend a little more time with this material and realize that it is a really cool story and not in need of nearly as much banter as we originally might have thought. But I'm glad we got to fit some of that in there at the end here. Thanks, Max, for sharing.
And thanks. And thanks for tuning in, fellow Ridiculous Historians. We would love to hear your stories about weird hobbies from days of yore. Let us know. You can find us on our Facebook page, Ridiculous Historians. You can also hit us up pretty much anywhere on social media, not just as a show, but as individuals. I am at Ben Bolin on Instagram. If you want spoilers for upcoming research and just weird rabbit holes I've fallen down, you can find me on Twitter at Ben Bolin HSW. How about you, Noel?
Catch me outside seaweeding or on Instagram exclusively, where I am at How Now Noel Brown. How about you, Max Williams?
Yeah, you can find my personal stuff on Twitter at @ATL_MaxWilliams. And since we talked about a lot of ephemeral on this, you can find out more about ephemeral on Instagram and Twitter at ephemeral.show. We actually have an episode, a two-part, coming out this week. It's about Erling Kagi. I believe I'm saying that name right. If you like the Peter Freudian episode of this show, you would love that episode as well. Very Peter Freudian-like.
I saw Alex post about it, saying that it was one of his favorite conversations he's ever had for this show. So I think it's going to be a really good one. I can't wait to check it out. And let me say really quickly, Ridiculous Stories, when Max says his personal stuff on Twitter, it gets quite personal. Let me tell you. Very spicy.
Ooh. It's pretty much your Twitter is just default setting on After Dark.
Hot Tub Talk with Max Williams.
Max Williams. I'll get there one day. Thank you, of course, to Max for spinning this straw into audio gold. Thanks, of course, to Mr. Casey Pegram. Thanks to Alex Williams. And thanks to our, at this point, long lost, much missed, sort of missed, nemesis, Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister.
Christopher Asiotis, Eve Jeffcoats, here in spirit. Everyone else, my mom, the ghost of Abraham Lincoln.
Tom Waits, you know.
Please, what is he building?
My dad.
No one knows. Yeah, the Colonel. And everyone else that we've forgotten. We love you all. And we'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts. But we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB.
That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.